Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And hello, my marvelous audience around the world. And of course, my guests from around the world. You'll soon meet him from Ireland. Folks, it's just great to be talking to you again. You know, every week I get to just speak with you. Some of you are new, some of you come back regularly, some of you listen live, some of you, really most of you, listen at your leisure on the archives. And remember that I now provide a new service, in a way, on the radio show. You can get to it by going to Breggin.com, look up at the top at my list of, you know, ongoing important things, and you'll see radio show. And I did find a way that you can actually search back several years, my entire radio career on my own anyway, and look up people. You can look up my guest today, Terry Lynch, and go back to 2015 and hear what he has to say. And remember that my website is updated. It's got new things on it. We're now going to be putting up to day number 9 in my frequent alerts, where I talk about breaking news, not necessarily about my work. This one, upcoming one, will be about events in Great Britain that reflect the dreadful effects America is having around the world in terms of children. Sometimes I'll be letting you know about a new blog that's come out, or a new scientific article, or a new legal case. So stay in touch. Go to the website. I'm going to try to be doing 4 of these frequent alerts a month. I may slip here and there. Terry, are you there? Am I loud and clear?
Yes, you're very loud and clear, Peter. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, very well. Very well.
I'm very happy to be here again.
It's really, really good. It's funny. I have just a few people around the world that I really think the world of, and Terry's one of them. On Terry Lynch's website, you can easily find Dr. Terry Lynch. William Glasser, you know, who is no longer with us, was a friend of mine, and a very hard man, you know, to just please. I mean, he just didn't think everybody was doing good work. And this is what he wrote about Terry Lynch. If ever a man puts a human face on mental suffering and offers an optimistic message, Dr. Lynch is that man. If I ever get seriously unhappy, I'm going to camp on Terry's doorstep.
Yeah.
And
that was very special.
Very, very special. And Dorothy Rowe, another friend of mine from Great Britain, a psychologist. Yeah. She and I have given talks together in Great Britain over the years.
Yeah.
She wrote another one. Let me read you this.
Over to Toxic Psychiatry, didn't she, in Britain?
Yes, that's right. Thank you. She wrote the Introduction to Toxic Psychiatry in Great Britain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Often grassroots ideas inspire people who would otherwise have lived quietly to do great things. One such person is Terry Lynch, an Irish GP. And I was very happy to see on Terry's page that he actually has quick access here to his hour on October 7th with me, 2015. The book at the top of his website is Selfhood. It's a good book. I checked out for fun the introduction to his course I think you pay for the course. He'll tell us about that. But the free preview of the course on bipolar disorder, cracking the code. And up to the point of what I could read for free, I mean, Terry's telling his patients and clients the same thing I am. Now, Terry Lynch is a general practitioner who just got involved in psychiatry. And is he ever involved? He's got good books. He's teaching courses that he puts online. I'd be very interested to have him sort of catch you up on what it's like to just be there telling the world in whatever way you can good news about your mental health. So welcome again to the show, Terry. It's really nice to hear your voice.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be here again, Peter. It's my third time, actually. I think I was on in 2012. But, you know, I've said to you before that I was on your show, I think, in 2012 as well, sometime like that. So it's my third time.
No, I'm sure. I know you were on another time. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. You know, you are such an icon, and you're an icon in my life. I've said this to you before, that reading Toxic Psychiatry was one of the transformative moments of my life. I saw you on Irish television about 25 years ago or so, and I was impressed, and I sort of filed you in the back of my mind, and then came across Toxic Psychiatry, and I read it. I read it on holidays once, actually, and really it copper-fastened and confirmed my own fears and my own concerns, and that was one of the turning points, really. Once I read that, in all conscience, I knew I had to change. And at the time, I was working as a GP, as you say, as a, I think in America, you might call it a family physician. But I just literally walked away from that in about 1989. I knew I needed something more meaningful for me. So I did an MA in psychotherapy, and I provide really a recovery-oriented mental health service for about the last 15 years. It's full-time. It's all I do. And then, as you said, the books and the courses. I suppose I feel in a unique enough position, well, not unique, but certainly an unusual position. And with that, I think, and I'm sure you might agree with, or identify with this, Peter, I feel a huge sense of responsibility and duty to contribute as much as I can to the very needed changes in global mental health. I mean, they are so needed. The current situation in regard to global mental health, where the medical model dominates, it's toxic, but it's one of the key things to me is that, can you hear me okay?
Oh, perfectly.
Yeah, perfectly. Sorry. One of the key things I think that the public need to wake up to here, you know, is that the vested interest of the medical profession. I think that's something that people miss. People assume that doctors, the most trusted profession in the world, perhaps, tell nothing but the truth and have no vested interest in this whole area of mental health. And what has dawned on me over the years is that actually the medical profession have a massive vested interest in maintaining this current status quo, where a myth of biology dominates global mental health. And it's so dangerous and it's causing so many problems. But I think the public need to wake up to the fact that the medical profession, to whom they look for the solutions, are actually a very big part of the problem.
I'm with you 100%. Just keep on talking about this whole global mental health. I don't think my audience hears very much from me or my guests about global mental health, though there's a huge amount of discussion of it in Great Britain. I don't imagine there's too much in the U.S. So talk more about this, and how is global mental health evolving? Who evolves it?
Well, I think it's, you know, global mental health currently is basically governed by a delusion. And that delusion is that mental health issues and problems are brain problems. And that is such a distortion of the truth. And from that one massive error of understanding, everything else follows. And so we have the whole area of psychiatric diagnoses, you know, from depression, general anxiety disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, OCD, eating disorder. This is a very serious issue. Societies have appointed as experts a group of people who are not experts, a group of people who promote a particular view, which is distorted and has no scientific basis. And the public think that that's the truth and that that's the best knowledge available. And it isn't. And the public fail to see, for understandable reasons, that actually the promoters of this viewpoint, you know, drug companies often get blamed, and with considerable reason. But the medical profession are the main drivers of this, and they're also the main beneficiaries of this. So as I see it, it's a global catastrophe or a global scandal. And one of the main reasons that that continues is that the public assume that what they hear from doctors is right and correct, and that doctors have the public and the patient's interests as their number one interest. And they don't, in my opinion. Many doctors, many psychiatrists, many family physicians, GPs, many are very well-meaning. But in terms of understanding the subtleties, the emotionality and psychology that compromises the bulk of all of these experiences and behaviors that come to be diagnosed as psychiatric diagnoses, they really are not in the game at all. And I think they're also resisting change because they have such a vested interest in maintaining the current status quo. In my book that I talked to you about, Depression Delusion, The Myth of the Brain Chemical Imbalance, I had a chapter in there, which I called Between a Rock and a Hard Place. And I later published that on Madden America blog. But in that, I was making the point that actually the current position whereby psychiatry purports to treat brain diseases, but there's no evidence, there's no diagnosis, there's no tests, that is actually psychiatry, vulnerable and all as that position is, it is actually psychiatry's ideal position, because they can maintain the lie between neurology, which deals with real brain disorders, and talk therapies, which deal with what are recognized as emotional and mental health problems. So the maintenance of this mythical, delusional idea that psychiatry treats brain disorders, it's a complete untruth, but it's essential for the maintenance of psychiatry's position, dominant position in global mental health. And this is the crux of the problem as I see it. Because Peter, as I know and you know, this is an absolute untruth. And until the public wake up to this and start questioning what on earth is going on here, I think, you know, I can't really see things changing massively until there's a groundswell of demanding truth and evidence. And I think I'm hoping that we will reach a tipping point which will just blow these lies out of the water and let them be replaced by truth and honesty and integrity.
Well, God, you're just saying it very, very, very well, and nothing could have more truth in it than what you are saying. The amount of money and power involved is so overwhelming. Yeah. I don't see a tipping point coming for me in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. What I see is the public gets more enlightened. I think they are.
Yeah.
And the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry ramp up. And so while we get more enlightenment, we're getting more and more patients getting the drugs.
Yes.
My researcher, Ian, recently traced the number of times psychiatric drugs were being discussed in the media. And it's a downward slope since 2003, 2004, 2005, when there was a bit of a peak surrounding the SSRIs being criticized and being carried in the media. I think the media is definitely withdrawing from taking any kind of critical looks because they get so much money in the U.S., from drug company advertising with our direct-to-consumer advertising.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting if somebody in the UK would do a similar data examination. I don't know how you do it. My researcher knows. But where you look and you see how much is a subject like psychiatric drugs being discussed. And it's actually been going down, despite all of our best efforts.
Yeah.
At least in the U.S.
I think a number of things strike me. one of the things, I've been thinking about this whole issue for so long. I mean, this is really in my work. It's my number one passion, this, you know, drive to change. And one of the things that has struck me is that I think that in order to provide a viable position to the public, that we need to present alternatives. We need to present alternative understandings and alternative responses. And I think that perhaps, you know, the whole movement towards change might have been a bit slow on that side, really, because I think, you know, the public hears maybe, you know, criticisms of drugs, etc., but they still find themselves, you know, in situations with problems, you know, people with the experiences that become diagnosed as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. They need help, and they need responses. And when the only response they've heard from so many sources is the medical drug-based response. So that's one of the reasons why I have focused on creating courses that set out deep understandings, not alternative understandings, but actually far more accurate understandings of what these things are, so that with that information, then with that understanding and knowledge, then we can carve out alternative pathways that make sense to people and that work and that are workable in the world, I suppose. I think that will help convince people, I think, if viable alternatives are created. And one of the things I've learned, for example, Peter, and I'm sure you would know this too, that, you know, the experiences and behaviors that become diagnosed as all of the psychiatric diagnoses, they're all understandable. They all make sense. And they make sense when they're approached from an emotional and psychological perspective. And of course, the medical model doesn't do that at all. It steers well clear of emotionality and psychology. And that's one of the things I've tried to do in the course, is to set out how we can actually make sense. So people can look at this, and therapists can look at this and say to themselves, gosh, the dots join up. Because I think you take psychosis or you take manic episodes, you know, the man in the street looks at those things and sees them as very different to the type of experiences and behaviors perhaps that they experience. So they can't make sense of this. They can't access an understanding that works for them in the world. So they don't develop faith then that there is an alternative to the medical model and to drugs. But, you know, and I know that there absolutely is. And I think that to me is something that I think is certainly something that I'm focusing on, to set out a kind of a chain to link up how a person gets from A to B to C to D to Z. And with that understanding, you know, once we know how somebody got to a place, that helps us and helps them to get out of that place.
Well, I think that's wonderfully put, and I agree with you so much. And of course, one of the problems we've had is that whenever decent residential type facilities are set up for really distressed people, if they're good, they get closed down. There's a long history of that going back actually a few centuries.
Yeah.
To the Tuke family and their Quaker-oriented facilities that didn't allow physicians to do their dirty work in there as they seem to think of it. And I'm going to be doing more and more of that. I have a course coming out this fall in why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. So it's about how to get the help you need and provide yourself the help you need to stop taking those drugs. And I'm hoping to create a course, Terry, that I'm working on it, that will provide professionals with certificates in psychotherapy based on my approach for them to use as they wish. And the public will be able to use it as they wish, use it to help each other and make it a part of their whatever their helping approach is to other people. But I really do agree with you. It's been a bit of my burden to have to be the man who's, you know, was the cutting edge and all the criticism. But
yes,
psychotherapy is, to me, and especially couples and family therapy is...
Yeah.
is in the long run the most important thing, because it's the healing approach. And as you say, it's not an alternative, it's a better approach.
Yes. Well, it's based very much, it's based very much on what people experience. You know, the medical model tells people that they've got something wrong with their brains and that that's causing everything. And that's never proven. That's never established. That's completely unevidenced. And you know, and I know that that's fundamentally unscientific, you know, to make statements. It's also unethical and immoral to tell somebody that they have something that's never been proven to exist. Whereas when we approach it, I think, from an emotional, I certainly agree with you, Peter, you know, psychotherapy can be very helpful. But I'm sure you agree with this. You know, I'm not suggesting that psychotherapy is always the answer at all. I would personally know well over 36 people who've made full recoveries from diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Some of them I worked with, many of them I didn't work with. Some of them had went to psychotherapy and others didn't. Others just found their own way through supports. And of course, a huge area too, Peter, and it was why I wrote Selfhood. You know, I'm at this work now, this particular work in mental health, and well over 50% of the people who come to me already have a psychiatric diagnosis, probably 70 to 80%. They've been given a psychiatric diagnosis elsewhere, and they come to me to see if there's anything else we can do. And almost completely, I would say, there is what I call reduced sense of self. You know, that the person's self-confidence, it's often called self-esteem, but there's much more to it than self-esteem. They feel disempowered, their self-expression is reduced, they feel unsafe and unable to make themselves feel safe in the world. And in Selfhood, for example, I have about 51 aspects of self just mentioned that struck me as I was working with people. And that sort of thing provides a real body of information with which to work. And so there isn't a need for theoretical, unproven, and in fact, if anything, disproved theories. If we just deal with what's right in front of us and hear the story, and you know, trauma, of course, is a grossly underestimated thing, and trauma is so frequently an issue in all of the psychiatric diagnoses. And you know, as I'm sure you well know, you know, trauma is often very subtle and very unnoticed. And I think that's another thing psychiatry has done, and my own feeling is that it's done quite deliberately, that trauma is, the bar for trauma is raised very high. You know, to have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, you've got to have, something absolutely catastrophic has had to have happened to you, to witness a murder or sexual assault or being involved in a war. You know, very extreme and, you know, really rarefying the number of people or reducing the number of people who can be described as being traumatized. And I think that's a deliberate attempt to sideline trauma and get that out of the way so that psychiatry can come in and take over. And I have yet to meet a person, well, maybe that's too strong a way of putting it, but the vast majority of people I have met with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, OCD, and these are the diagnoses made before coming to me, there is almost always subtle, sometimes not so subtle, but often subtle trauma that's accumulated or that just hasn't been worked through, you know, unfinished emotional business. And I think it's really this sort of picture, if the public were presented with an accessible explanation for the experiences and behaviors, I think more members of the public would be open to it. I the other day I put up a video on YouTube. It was a video from my course, the bipolar disorder cracking the code, and it was about psychosis. And you know, the common theme, of course, with psychosis is that it's so out there, it's so unusual that it must be caused by a brain problem. And it isn't. It quite clearly isn't. Well, first of all, there's no evidence that it is. But when you actually, maybe you've seen this too, Peter, but, you know, psychosis makes sense. It makes complete sense. It's very common that people who reach that point of a psychosis have been experiencing profound overwhelm and find themselves in a situation, in a reality that is just too much to handle. And so they need to get out of that reality. And psychosis can be a way of removing themselves from that awful reality to a safer place. And you know, when we are prepared to actually look in a more broad way, we see that these experiences and behaviors, they're not crazy at all. They're actually defense mechanisms, coping strategies, they're self-protection strategies. They're actually intelligent in their own way. And that invites us to approach emotional mental health globally in a very different way to this fundamentally nonsensical medical psychiatric diagnosis approach, you know. And you know, and some of the listeners would know that the DSM, you know, the Bible upon which these diagnoses are made, is no more than a collection of opinions and consensus. There's no science in that. And again, that's something the public don't know. So there's so much misinformation that the public have understandably swallowed as truth. You know, to me, it's one of the greatest lies in society, the whole thing.
Oh, I agree with you. And I love the way you talk about it. I don't have any essential disagreements with you. Trauma often produces results that really are meaningful, but just need help to understand. People who I think the people who get labeled schizophrenic are just the more imaginative people in the ways they respond to trauma.
Yeah.
So they develop broken poetry and symbols and strange ideas. And I think it comes partly out of the injured creativity.
Yes. And I think also... sorry, Peter. Yeah.
No, go ahead. I want you to talk.
I was just going to say, you know, a really common feature that I have noticed over and over again in the people who I've met who've been diagnosed with schizophrenia is profound powerlessness. You know, when I was a medical student training in medicine, and including psychiatry, the term learned helplessness was commonly used. It's not used much now at all, because I think it's been removed, because it's not a scientific term, it's a psychological term. But the idea of learned helplessness and learned powerlessness is so real in within the psychiatric diagnosis. And one of the things that struck me in terms of, for example, schizophrenia, is that some of that creativity, and perhaps quite a lot of it, happens through daydreaming, through fantasy creation. Quite often, I think, in my experience anyway, because the person has lost faith in their ability to make things happen for themselves in the real world, they've lost faith in their ability to take risks, and the wounding has resulted in them feeling that risk taking is just too risky, basically, that it could cause further woundings, further trauma. So I've certainly met many people diagnosed with schizophrenia who have, again, we could say intelligently, based on that perception of themselves in the world, withdrawn from actually risk-taking in the real world, and have gone more into their own world, which is a safer place for them to be, and have lived within that world, creating various forms of daydreaming, fantasy creation, because in that world, A, they're safer, and B, they can often make good things happen in their mind that they wish would happen in the real world, but they don't see any way that they can make them happen in the real world. So I approach everything really, Peter. My first perspective with any person I'm working with is let's try to find out the rightness of this person's feelings and behaviors, not the wrongness. And then from that, we can work to see what we can do. But the first things first, all human behavior, all human feelings are purposeful at some level. And I think that helps, that conveys a sense of respect as well, a sense of respect and honoring the person, which can be very helpful to create a good relationship with the person in which they're more likely, I think, to open up and to share more of their story. You know, another very important concept I often think about is sovereignty, the sovereignty of the individual. And I think the prevailing approach to mental health fails to see the sovereignty of the individual, and that the individual is in their own way constructing their world in the way that works to some degree for them. And I've seen that time and time again, that is missed. And when that is acknowledged, that opens up all sorts of doors A, of understanding accurately and empathizing accurately, but also of creative and positive ways to work with the person once you actually get where they're at, how they think, how they operate in the world. And of course, the medical model doesn't look at those things at all.
I'm with you 100%, Terry. I'm trying to think of how to bring out even more your approach to people. I think it's really getting across. Can you tell us more about what happens? I mean, it's so hard for us to do this as therapists, it's just off the top of our heads. But can you tell us more about what happens between you and a client? You call them clients or patients?
Clients.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the reason why I've created the courses is to set these things out in detail. I mean, I have a depression course with 17 hours of material on it. And the bipolar course has currently over 9 hours, and I'm still working on that. So it's to set out the detail. But what happens is, I suppose I present myself as an ordinary person, you know? And I said, not as a doctor, I don't particularly like being called doctor. I like to be called by my first name. I mean, I see myself as no different to the person sitting in front of me. We're sharing a human experience. And so I set out, particularly with people who have been very traumatized, well, really with everybody, to set out, number one, to make sure they feel safe and secure in the place. And I do what I can to that's one of my priorities. And to really, I suppose, let the person dictate a lot of the particularly the early interactions, because for somebody who has felt perhaps quite overwhelmed and overpowered in life, the last thing they want is me to come in and take over the conversation. And I think quite often in that type of situation, they may well be used to that in their life, and they certainly may well be used to that with their psychiatrists. But one of the key things, I think, is to encourage the person to express who they are. So in a way, I invite the person to tell me who they really are at their own pace. And quite often in that dynamic, magical things can happen because the person can, sometimes for the first time, risk actually revealing more of who they really are and their inner world, you know, how they think, how they feel. I also intermittently reflect back what they say to me, I suppose, in a way of illustrating that I understand. You know, I can never know what somebody's thinking, but I can often know how they're thinking, the patterns of thinking. And I think that's very affirming for people to have their way of thinking and living and feeling validated, because they're so used to being invalidated. You know, to me, you know, mania makes perfect sense. Depression, what we call depression, makes perfect sense. And there's such a story in there, a story of habits and patterns that are developed in response to the person's struggle to live, struggle to get through the day, struggle to survive the hundreds of interactions they have in the day. Like, it's no mystery to me why people withdraw. People who end up with a diagnosis of depression or schizophrenia or bipolar withdraw. And I think, you know, so that's really how I come at it, from a place of that, you know, let's make sense of your story. Let's make sense of your story, and let's join together then to progress things at a pace that works, not for me, but a pace that works for you. So there are some of the principles by which I work.
Do you work with couples? Very, very similar again, Terry, obviously to how I think. I mean, it's really quite similar. Yeah. Do you work with couples and families at all? I have such good experiences helping couples help each other, and just recently I had a client come in with his wife, and then he brought his mother and father into town and had them come, and mom's revelations about his childhood and her communications about what she felt she'd done to contribute to his problems as well as to strengthen him was so honest and honorable, and it was just such a healing experience for both of them, both my original client and the mother, and also his father. Do you ever do that kind of work?
I do, yeah. The majority of my work is one-to-one, you know, with just individuals. I don't do much what we might call couple therapy, but I would often see situations where meeting a family member, a loved one, and, you know, an important person in the part, just like you're saying there, you know, I do it frequently, can really contribute to the whole situation, both to my, I suppose, my understanding and to the healing, because there can be such sorrow and pain within the family, within relationships. And I find that many times that, and it also helps to understand the dynamics of what's going on. So yeah, I do that quite often. One or two other things that just struck me there, Peter. I try to just keep my eyes open for patterns, you know, patterns of how people live and how people, for example, handle emotions. Because we learn in our society, and this is very common within psychiatric diagnoses, we learn to suppress emotions. We learn, and some people will suppress most of their emotions. Other people may suppress their sorrow and tears and become very comfortable in their anger. And then other people are the opposite. So other people are very uncomfortable very uncomfortable with anger and easily go into their sorrow. So I often look at the balance of emotions and try to help the person awaken, shall we say, whatever emotions have been silenced. I often find that, for example, someone who, and again, I see this, if you take what is called general anxiety disorder, which really it's a description, and all it really means is we haven't found a reason for your anxiety, so we're calling it generalized. And I regularly find in people who haven't been given a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder, that is unfinished emotional business in there. And, you know, quite often it can be unexpressed sorrow, tears, sometimes unexpressed anger, and sometimes just unexpressedness, like, I mean, just a person who has, for various reasons during their life, learned to suppress their self-expression. And I often find that working with these sort of areas, the person comes into themselves more and the anxiety diminishes because it's not needed anymore. You know, the anxiety quite often is an expression of something else. It's an expression of what is not dealt with, what is lingering within the person, but hasn't been worked through to completion.
Well, it makes a great deal of sense to me, a great deal of sense. Do you talk about love with your patients?
Yeah, I do. I do. I suppose it kind of depends on the situation, but I do, yeah.
Tell me about that. Because I think it's the essence, and it's what I like to tell people, I think my clients, anybody who will listen, yeah, is that if you're feeling loving, you can't be crazy. And if you get love in return, you won't feel isolated and alone.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Peter.
Go ahead.
I think probably the most common form of love I talk about is self-love, actually. Encouraging people to, you know, I would have met many people with psychiatric diagnoses, I'm sure you have too, who have a kind of we might call it an inconsistent approach to liking and disliking and loving and not loving. They can feel quite loving towards other people and very positive towards other people, but hating themselves. And that's a very common theme within psychiatric diagnosis. So helping people come into loving themselves, I do quite a lot of work on that. Some of the people I meet in my work, people with, say, diagnosis, particularly of the schizophrenia, bipolar, some of them, because of the level of wounding they've had, either have never been able to risk entering a loving relationship, or if they did, often find it very difficult to maintain that because their sense of self is so in doubt, so low, that the risk involved in giving themselves to another person can be quite overwhelming. And so a lot of people in those kind of areas, I think, and depression and others too, just find the whole process of relating and relationships so risky and so unpredictable. You know, I think when we've been quite wounded, and wounding, of course, is one of the core things here, wounding, distress, shock, defense mechanisms. When we've been quite wounded, we find risk-taking really quite difficult. And I suppose there's nothing or very few things in life more risky than giving our hearts to somebody else and hoping that it will work. But yes, I mean, I had that very situation where we talked about love in terms of the broader sense of it and you know, the person's capacity to love and be loved. And I suppose I often, if I sense, for example, that somebody, I often use my own reaction to somebody as a bit of a barometer. And I would have met many people that really strike me as having fabulous spirits, you know, and really good people, but they're not aware of it. And I would often then, you know, ask them about people in their life and how people react to them. And I would say, well, there you go. You know, these people see who you are. They see the loving being that you are and what an amazing person you are. You know, it is okay to actually risk seeing that. And I often find that when people do risk that, that emotion comes up, you know, that they connect in with themselves, and that warmth kind of melts the ice that they've felt the need to protect their heart with. So absolutely love. And in lots of ways, I think this work is love. You know, it's loving work because you're meeting somebody heart to, well, you're meeting somebody being to being, heart to heart, spirit to spirit, two human beings sharing a human experience, exploring the difficulties of life, you know. And I would sometimes talk to people about what's happened in my life too, because, you know, I some therapists might operate from the perspective that you should never discuss yourself with clients, but I think it can be helpful sometimes for people to hear something of your own story. It kind of equalizes things and makes them get the sense that, God, this guy's human too. You know, this guy doesn't just preach it. He's been there to some degree himself, you know. And I think there's no mystery here. There should be no mysticism to emotional and mental health. And the whole psychiatric approach has created mystery and mysticism. An elitism in terms of who is supposed to understand these things. You know, and I know this is not rocket science. It's humanness and human experience and behavior, and it needs a human response, primarily.
I'm sitting here smiling because if we exchanged accents, you would be saying all the things that I might say. The correspondence in our views is so, so remarkable, and coming from, you know, somewhat different backgrounds, places in the world, and even training. It's just a pleasure to hear you say things in a very fresh way that I've thought about for a long time, and that really govern how I try to do therapy, and how with that same loving enthusiasm that you're describing. I think it's just so important. You know, and one of the things about, you know, seeing so many of our clients really are unusual people in very positive ways. I think outside the normal range of what I might find to be, you know, somebody who's really inspiring. I find so many of my clients to be that way. And I think partly, when particularly potentially inspiring and exciting and loving people are born into a family that is dreary, oppressed, hurt, angry, that miraculous child is not greeted very well and not treated very well. Yeah. And often jealousy and anger and even abuse can be heaped upon that. And that's one of the things I want people to think about. If you feel especially hateful to yourself and you look back on your family life and you've been especially just treated like junk by your family, there's a very, very good chance that they were sensing in you a life spirit that in their minds put them to shame or threatened them. And so you got their anxieties and shame and guilt pinned on you. And it's a hard concept because who could believe, yeah, I really was a wonderful baby, a wonderful child, and look what they did to me. But it goes together in many cases. Go ahead.
I've seen that, and there are other variants of that. Another area where a lot of young people get wounded is in peer groups and in school. And I've seen, just like you said, I've seen so many gifted young people be hurt and wounded very much too in their peer group and in school. And, you know, in late childhood and in teenage years, peers are vying for position, they're vying for popularity. And, you know, sometimes, well, certainly here in Ireland, and I can't imagine it's that different in America, the amount of viciousness and bullying and harassment that can happen within peer groups can be just absolutely dreadful. And I've seen many, and from families too, yes, I've seen that too. Another important thing, Peter, I've noticed many times, you know, people often say when somebody ends up having a psychiatric diagnosis like bipolar or depression or schizophrenia, you know, they came from a great family, you know, there was nothing wrong, nothing happened. And I've met many people who have come from families who were really very good families. And what happened quite often in those families was that they just didn't spot certain things. You know, that maybe one child, I've seen situations, for example, where one child was particularly gifted or particularly vocal, shall we say. And then that child became the one upon whom the spotlight was shone regularly. So say a sibling of that child, or if there's two or three other siblings, they were in the shadows. And nobody was doing this deliberately. It just didn't strike people that this was having a very strong negative effect on the kids who weren't in the spotlight, because they were comparing themselves to their sibling, and they were in their own minds, they were not able to match up to their siblings. That is something I've seen many times, and nobody's trying to hurt anybody there, but it's just, again, because we haven't in our society focused sufficiently on psychological and emotional awareness, that parents aren't educated in these kind of things. And so parents often miss the subtleties of that sort of thing, where one child goes quiet and people just think, well, he's a quiet child, he's happy enough, he's fine. And another child is confident and secure in themselves. But that's because, well, there's a number of reasons, but quite often they're getting validated all the time for what they say and do. So they develop confidence. You know, we develop confidence by doing. So a child who gets used to and confident about speaking to people and speaking to peers and speaking to adults and the interacting and the toing and froing of interactions and things not working and things working, you know, that child is going to be better prepared for the world. Whereas the child who goes quiet and suppresses a lot, you know, who may seem happy and seem confident enough to a certain point, they're often the kids who come their young teens really start to struggle. And I think, you know, it's no coincidence whatsoever that by far the most common age group for all psychiatric diagnosis, I think, is somewhere between about 14 and 25, when people are coming of age, coming into adulthood. And if a child has, to some degree, to quite a degree, lost their sense of self by the time they're 12 or 13, and often that goes unseen, then they're much more likely to struggle with the rapid waters of teenage years. And they're the ones who are, in my experience, far more likely to end up with diagnoses of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, etc., and eating disorders. And again, I think it's no coincidence that, you know, psychiatry focuses on symptoms and disease, right? Whereas actually if we look at what people do and what happens, one of the common themes of virtually all psychiatric diagnosis is withdrawal, you know, pulling back from the world. And I think that's a real light bulb to us. People pulling back, say, withdrawing from school, withdrawing from college, withdrawing from peers. Why would they do that? You know, psychiatrists say, well, that's the disease. No, it's not. It is because they are finding staying with their peers, staying with that environment, progressively more difficult. So they're faced with difficult choices, and many decide, I just can't handle that, I have to withdraw. And that withdrawal then causes major, they already have accumulated a lot of wounding and trauma, but then that withdrawing causes more heartbreak. And I've met so many people who've had various psychiatric diagnosis, you know, in their mid-20s, late-20s. And one of their major sources of pain is the loss of time, the loss of years, the loss of living. And I mean, psychiatry just doesn't even see those things and just keeps telling people, well, keep your tablets and you'll be fine. And that's not okay. You know, people have lives and people are entitled. Surely it's a right, a fundamental human right, that a person should have every opportunity to live well, to live to the best of their ability. And you know, if the authorities, if governments would sit back and take a serious look at this, they would see that there's actually a huge amount of money to be saved here. As you well know, and I know, and many of our listeners would know, you know, what are the costs of, what are the major costs involved in emotional mental health problems? One of the major costs is loss of work hours, loss of people not being able to work, disability costs. And, you know, they are the product largely of the person finding themselves just not able to cope with the world as they find it. And if that was worked with, if that single thing was worked with comprehensively, the money that could be saved. And of course, it's not about the money. But in a way, you know, it just, if governments would wake up and just take the glasses off, for the blinkers off, and ask themselves, are the people, the particularly the psychiatrists who are promoting this current model, are they really doing everything that could be done? And should they stand back and listen to other voices? And in my opinion, they absolutely should.
I agree with all of your thrusts, except that those last few words, because I don't think the answer is ever going to be getting psychiatrists to listen, because they have to...
I agree. No, I didn't. Sorry, Peter, I didn't mean that. I meant the politicians to listen.
Good. Okay.
I meant the authority, as in the people who run our country. I totally agree. I don't waste my time trying to convince psychiatrists. I stopped that years ago because they are the most biased. They are the most, you know, it's a church. It's an ideology. And they are the high priests, and the high priests are always the ones who hold on to the ideology no matter what. So I completely agree with you there. I would not waste a second of my time trying to convince psychiatrists.
It may amuse you, Terry, that we're so similar in the way we think, that I wrote a blog a while back about psychiatry as a materialistic religion.
Yes.
That was giving materialistic answers to psychological and spiritual questions.
Yes.
And practically every time I go into court as an expert witness, a leering attorney on the other side will say, and you've called psychiatry a materialistic religion.
Yes, which is right. You know, it's interesting that virtually everything psychiatrists say affirms their position, and they bring it back all the time into, it's all about the disease, it's all about the diagnosis, not about the experience, not about the human being. That's right. Not about the human being, their life, their struggles. Absolutely, yes. And I mean, it's really, when you stand back and look at it, it's so clear. It is a system of public delusion and a system of self-aggrandizement. And I think the only thing that keeps that together or keeps that working is that the public trust doctors and the public assume that these doctors must have the public interest at heart. They absolutely do not, in my opinion. And I know you would share that. You know, I've seen thousands of examples of that in my work. And you know, they just don't want to hear argument. They don't want to hear. I often, from time to time, I'll tweet something or put something up on Facebook, and occasionally a psychiatrist will respond. It's always just a disparaging comment, you know, and it's the what's it called again? The straw man. Is it the attacking the person rather than the what the person says, which of course is false, flawed logic to begin with. But I take them on gently and gradually, and they always back off. Because they don't have any answers, really. When you get beyond the first answer or second answer and you keep at them, they have no substance. It's a charade. And if the public would just come to see that through proper education, I think we really then could have the foundations of a major shift.
Well, I'm with you again. What about spirituality? You brought up the false religion aspect of psychiatry, which is, I think, very strong, yes, and why people turn to it, because they hunger for explanations on a big scale about what's happening to their lives. What kind of spirituality do you bring into your life and into therapy?
Well, that's a big one, Peter. You kept the big one towards the end, huh?
Well, I actually didn't know I was going to ask you.
No, I thought joking.
You brought up religion.
No, it's a great question. I mean, it's a great question. I treat the work as human work. And to me, spirituality is an inbuilt part of our humanness. So to me, the spiritual side is in the room. I don't always name it, but it's there, and it's there in the relating and in the respect and the honoring that goes on in the room. I suppose I feel that so many people have their own versions of spirituality and religion. And I don't generally bring it up, shall we say, except in that very human way, I suppose, that I'm describing, of just absolute validation and respect and honor for the person sitting in front of me, and a really full-on acceptance of who they are. And to me, that is spirituality. That's spirituality in action, I suppose. And, you know, to me, that, the religious beliefs of the individual are largely irrelevant to me personally. If the person brings them up, then we will discuss them and again, see how we can kind of work with them. But again, it has to be in keeping with their perceptions and their what they've constructed. Because if I set about trying to deconstruct their religious beliefs, then I'm doing them a massive disservice. So I see it as a very important part of the work, but I don't always name it, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I understand perfectly. I'm more direct about it. I find that in America,
yes,
the great majority of people, not the most vocal people, but the great majority have a belief in God.
I've seen that,
And they have a belief, or at least wish to believe, in a loving God. Yes. And I will often ask people what their religious beliefs are. And if they wish, talk about how their religious beliefs can strengthen their what you call risk taking. I don't usually use that term in therapy. I think it's a great term. How believing that there's a God who cares and loves can help us with risk taking, with being honest and honorable and ethical and loving when it looks like a really scary and dangerous thing to do. So I actually do get more directly into conversations with people about the role of God in their life. Of course, I don't proselytize.
Yeah, but, I think that is very much in keeping with what I do, though, in the sense that you're talking about connecting in with their inner world and what matters to them. And here in Ireland, it's interesting. You know, Ireland is a very different country now to what it was 30, 40 years ago, Peter, when you were here on the Pat Kenny show way back when I saw you. The whole religion situation in Ireland has changed beyond recognition for various reasons. And a lot of people have lost faith in the church here. So that, depending on the age, etc., you know.
Yeah. Again, we got to finish up now. Yeah. I just let us run over. Love talking with you. One of the things I tell people is separate God from the institutions of man, and you will have a much healthier spiritual life.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Terry Lidge. Thank you.
Peter, can I just say one thing?
Okay.
Yeah, just to honor my presence on this course, Peter, if people email me at terry@drterrylynch.com, that's T-E-R-R-Y at drterrylynch.com, D-O-C-T-O-R, terrylynch.com, just email me at that. And if they're interested in any of the courses, I'll give them about a 30% discount in honor of my presence on your show. I'm a great fan of yours, Peter, and I wouldn't be doing this, I think, only for you.
All right, my friend. Bye-bye now.
Okay, Peter. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.